With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong
with great power,
is something right.
Comes
even
great
if the whole
responsibility.
World is telling you. Compromise where you can. It is your duty.
Where you can't.
To plant yourself like a tree. Look them in the eye and say no. You move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Welcome in, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but for some reason we had issues with our audio earlier, and now, for whatever reason, we're not broadcasting on Facebook. I don't really understand why, but if anybody could figure that out and help me out with that, I'd certainly appreciate it. But as of right now, I'm looking at the page, and it doesn't seem to be taking. But luckily, we do broadcast on more than one medium, so if you're not watching us on Facebook, you can still get there from the Facebook page or from Tactics by going to our YouTube page. I posted the link up there for that if you happen to be wondering what's going on there. Well, that's why. That's why we're not broadcasting directly to Facebook Live right now. You can just get there through the YouTube channel or Twitch or Periscope if you want to go find our page there, and we certainly appreciate people that support us on those venues as well. Before we do get into some local news of the day, because that is, of course, top priority here in News Radio 1440, we try to focus on what's going on here in the state of Alabama and in the River Region. But before we do that, there are a couple of international stories that I want to at least touch on. We're not going to spend much time here, just primarily asking for prayer requests more than anything else. Because there are two situations that have arisen in the Middle East in the past 48 hours that are incredibly important. They're important for us in Alabama, and they're important for everyone in the world because of what it does to the world stage. First of all is Israel. Right now, what is going on is that Israel has had, in the past couple of days, 600 rockets fired upon them by terrorists in Hamas. In the country surrounding them, that terrorist organization, Hamas, has been launching over 600 rockets over the course of the weekend. And I mean, there is no other country on earth that is expected to put up with something like that. If, for example, Canada or Mexico, and I know that this is weird to even think about, but let's say that Canada or Mexico, countries on our border, had terrorist groups within their nation and allowed those groups and even supported those groups firing missiles on the United States of America. If they fired on New Mexico or Texas or California, you better believe that country would cease to exist within the next 24 hours. I mean, you would see, even though those are first world countries, you would see our military react swiftly. In 9/11, we basically went in and took out two entire countries in the aftermath of what happened there for killing 3,000 of our people and flying planes into buildings both in New York and D.C. And that was an appropriate response, but my point is, Israel is expected to basically just take it. And considering we've already seen casualties from these rockets, we've already seen some of the horrible effects of this, and we do pray for the people of Israel, and I ask you at home to pray for the people of Israel going through this, that there will be some kind of respite when it comes to this so that they may be able to find peace one day. That area of the world has been at war for, you know, roughly 1,400 years, so I think that peace may be a little bit of a pipe dream at this point, but nonetheless, we do pray for our allies in Israel that just want to live there and exist, and we pray that the evil people that are committing these acts of terror against them, against civilians — these are not targeted attacks or targeted strikes, these are specifically at random civilian locations. There are people that are not engaged in the military whatsoever. These are not military targets. They're just firing in because if your goal is to destroy Jews, you don't really care which Jews get destroyed. When your end goal is to eliminate a certain genetic population off the face of the earth, you're really not too concerned with whether or not they're a soldier or a two-year-old. And that's the kind of evil that Israel is facing right now. And another situation over in the Middle East that directly involves the United States, not just one of our allies, is there has been an aircraft carrier deployed and is supposed to reach Iran about 2 weeks earlier than originally they were originally planning to. Essentially, this is because there have been troubling concerns and reports that Iran is, because of some of the squeeze they're feeling because of the sanctions, they're thinking about ratcheting up their attack plan. And because of that, just as a safety precaution to make sure that we have everybody over there that we need to keep our people over in the area safe, to keep Iran from firing on U.S. targets, we're adding a little extra protection and a little extra security. So I do ask that everybody pray for that situation, and hopefully that situation will be diffused as well. But there's a lot going on in the Middle East and a lot, unfortunately, to be worried about. So I do ask everybody, just please continue to pray for that area in the world. It's very volatile. It's a place that may never actually see some kind of lasting peace. But nonetheless, if anybody can do it, it's not going to happen without God's help. And that's why I ask everybody to continue to pray for that. Now, into some local news. And even though this is not nearly as big a deal, it's not quite as life or death situation, it is something that I also find very disappointing and that I am saddened by. It turns out that as the Senate race, which is not going to happen now for another, about year and a half, as the Senate race heats up, it turns out that Mo Brooks has officially said that he is not going to run. In an interview the other day with Talk 95.5, which, by the way, that's our sister station, News Radio 1440, Talk 95.5, and WVNN are all the Cumulus stations here in the state of Alabama, and so they're one of our sister stations up there in Birmingham. Mo Brooks was giving an interview with them, with Matt Murphy, and he said that he might consider a 2020 run, but only if Richard Shelby retires. He says if Richard Shelby decides to seek re-election, and there's a good chance he's going to retire. I mean, the man is, if I'm not mistaken, in his 80s now, if not late 70s for sure. And remember that in the Senate, these are six-year terms. So I would imagine, and I would honestly hope, that Richard Shelby would retire and spend the rest of his, and I'm not saying this because Shelby and I have had our differences over the years. I'm saying this because I really would like to see Shelby spend out, you know, the sort of winter part of his life and with his family. I think that that would be appropriate, and I think it is time for some fresh blood to move into his spot. He's held that position in the Senate for longer than I've even been alive. But nonetheless, Richard Shelby may very well retire, and then Mo Brooks would consider running for the Senate, but he said that is the only way that he will consider a Senate run right now. He's saying for sure that the 2020 election that is coming up, he's not going to seek re-election when it comes to that one. So here was the official statement by Brooks on this on the radio show that he gave. He said, in 2017, I had assurances from the White House that Donald Trump would either endorse me or be neutral. I didn't anticipate that he would endorse, but I thought he'd be neutral. We relied on those representations, decided to run for the United States Senate, would have come in second in the primary but for Mitch McConnell forces, perhaps others persuading, using whatever measures of persuasion they had, persuading Donald Trump to endorse Luther Strange. That pushed Luther into the second, and the rest is history. Doug Jones ended up getting elected in a ruby-red state. Is that a fair summary of what happened? I think that it may be slightly generous, maybe slightly exaggerated, but not by much, because there's no way to really know whether or not Mo Brooks would have come in second had Donald Trump not intervened and endorsed Luther Strange and had Mitch McConnell not poured literally millions of dollars into trying to get Luther Strange reelected, specifically by smearing Mo Brooks. He didn't even really run any positive ads that I'm aware of. He just ran attack ads against Mo Brooks. But anyway, that's what happened. And I do find it ironic that a lot of the people that were very loyal Trump supporters that presumably don't like Mitch McConnell very much and think of him as a rhino, and by the way, they're not incorrect in that analysis, that it's those very people that were swayed by the anti-Trump ad saying that Mo Brooks was anti-Trump and saying he was against the wall, which is patently absurd and ridiculous by anybody that has spent any time looking through Mo Brooks' record. he was not an early endorser of Trump, but he was also not, keep in mind, I say this as somebody that was a part of the Never Trump movement, and Mo Brooks was not part of the Never Trump movement. I say that as somebody that was, believe me, he wasn't. He wasn't an early endorser, but he wasn't somebody that was railing against Donald Trump to win either. And so Mitch McConnell tried to launch this ad saying that, launched several ads, spent millions of dollars in the state of Alabama saying that Mo Brooks was against Trump and he was for open borders and all this other ridiculous garbage that Mitch McConnell just straight up lied about. And it's ironic that the people that tend to worship at Trump's feet and think that anybody that has ever said anything less than absolutely glowing about President Trump are the very ones that were persuaded by Mitch McConnell not to vote for Mo Brooks. And as a result, Doug Jones is what you got. Now, again, we can't live in this world where we have these what-if scenarios that we know perfectly what would have happened if this had happened. And personally, I've never been one that put a whole lot of stock into endorsements shaping elections that much. But in this case, it might actually be true. And the reason I say that is having the endorsement of President Trump, or at the very least Trump remaining neutral, would have stopped a lot of the sentiment that Brooks was anti-Trump and would have helped to curb that idea at least somewhat. I don't know if the results would have been different, but there's no question that the results that we got were severely less than ideal. And that Mo Brooks, had he got the Republican nomination, there's no question in my mind that Mo Brooks would be our senator right now. Not a single doubt in my mind. But again, we can't play the what-if game, but I just don't see a scenario where if Mo Brooks winds up being the Republican candidate, that Doug Jones beats him. I cannot foresee that as a possibility, and there's no question that Mo Brooks would have been a phenomenal senator. And the idea that Trump, had Trump not endorsed him and had Trump himself stayed out of it and not endorsed Luther Strange, there would have been a less crossover from people that were Trump supporters over to the Luther Strange camp. So that's one of the big reasons that I think that the endorsement actually did make a difference here. Although it does show what a dirty game politics is. That Mitch McConnell, who himself was not a big Trump supporter and was a very late person to endorse Donald Trump, basically accused a much more conservative Mo Brooks of being someone who was a liberal who supported a bunch of liberal policies and hated the president. It is very ironic to me that somebody that is much further to the left of Mo Brooks was trying to accuse Mo Brooks of being too far to the left to be elected. But that's how the game is played, unfortunately. And before we go to the phones and get some comments on this, I will say that even though I'm disappointed, I get where Mo Brooks is coming from. I wish that he would run, but I understand why he doesn't. In fact, he said in the interview, quote, "You get kicked by a mule once and it's the mule's fault. You get kicked twice, well, it's your own fault." I get what he's saying. Running a statewide campaign is hard. It costs a lot of money. It's a thankless job. There's a lot of effort involved in it on top of his duties already as being a member of the House of Representatives. And at the end of the day, you may wind up getting absolutely nothing from it, which is what happened to him the last time that he did this. So I get where he's coming from. But I will say this, I think he's far more likely to win this campaign than he's giving himself credit for. Because now, at least at the moment, Roy Moore's not there. Luther Strange is not there. And the only person in the race right now that has declared that has a better name recognition than him is Tommy Tuberville. And there have been some serious questions about his electability just because he has literally zero government experience. That may be a good thing, that may be a bad thing. But my point is, if the only guy with more name recognition than you is the guy that's never run for office before, that means you've got a pretty decent shot. And so I think that Mo Brooks isn't, frankly, giving himself quite enough credit. Now, I'm a big Mo Brooks fan. Maybe my own bias is blinding me a little bit and thinking that he has a better shot than he actually does. I think he's got a good shot, and I actually pointed out why he is the candidate that, in my mind, based on the numbers and based on the polling, has the best shot of actually winning the primary. But You know, I guess now we'll never know. Now, Mo Brooks was also asked who he would vote for, and he said this about Bradley Byrne. Bradley Byrne, I know him fairly well. I like him on a personal level. He's got a pretty good record on a number of issues that are important to me. I have no troubles whatsoever with voting for him over Doug Jones. Okay, so Mo Brooks' assessment of Bradley Byrne is, good guy, like him, conservative voting record. Yeah, I'd vote for him over Doug Jones, no question. His analysis on somebody that you may not have heard of, here he goes. You may see Arnold Mooney, who was my campaign chairman in 2017, get in. I really like Arnold Mooney. Should he get in, he's probably my first choice. Well, no, not probably, he is my first choice. That's ultimately who I would vote for if Arnold got in, based in part on my personal knowledge of him, and also based on his support for me in 2017. All right, so looks like, at least right now, Mo Brooks' mind is made up. That if Arnold Mooney runs, and by the way, we're going to get into, he actually did formally declare just recently, that if Arnold Mooney runs, that's the horse that he plans on backing. He also talked very briefly on Tommy Tuberville. He seemed kind of lukewarm on him, but basically said, but I'd still vote for him over Doug Jones, which I think is a sentiment a lot of Alabamians have, whether they really like Tuberville or are really kind of meh about him. Either way, and I tend to be more in the meh category, but either way, still vote for him over Doug Jones. No question about that. And, you know, it's a real shame. It's a real shame that he's not going to run. And I hate to see it, but I guess this means that now I'm firmly in the Jim Ziegler camp. If Jim Ziegler actually declares right now, if I had to vote today and he was in the race, Jim Ziegler would be the one that I cast my vote for. Let's go ahead and go to the phones. Good afternoon. What's your name?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello.
Hang on. Hello, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, I can hear you, but very faintly. Give me 1 second to make a quick adjustment.
Sure. Perhaps the audience can at least hear my dialogue.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
There we go. Is that better?
A little bit.
I was just going to say yes, 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 because you said the phrase that is music to my ears.
Oh?
Ziegler, you're supporting?
Yeah, I would support right now if I had to vote. Like I said, I would support Jim Ziegler.
Yeah, well, that's outstanding because, and I like Tubbs, too. I just don't know what his chances are given the orange and blue that would always be attached to him in this particular state.
Sure.
But, you know, I don't know. But as far as Doug Jones is concerned, I see an Australian Shepherd in front of me that I would vote for over him.
Oh, I'd definitely vote for an Australian Shepherd.
Yeah. Well, one thing, they have more intellect. But nevertheless,
exactly.
I think that one of the problems I think that Mo Brooks has, and maybe this is just something that resonates with me, I don't think he's got a cool enough name.
You think that's the problem?
I think that's one of the problems. And I do think that the president right now, his endorsement carries more weight with it than any person I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
In this state. I mean, it more in my lifetime than anyone else. And that's why so many of them were out trying to out-Trump each other. You know.
Yeah, it's weird because we're actually not... It's not an uncommon thing in the state of Alabama. It's just usually, and I think that this may speak ill of our society right now, usually what's going on in Alabama is they're trying very hard to out-Christian one another and talk about how many Bible classes they've taught and how they've been preachers and all. Now it seems weird that we've shifted to now they're trying to out-Trump each other. I don't know what that says about us as a society.
I don't know either, because I never thought that so many people in Alabama, and honestly, I like a lot of the things the president has done.
Oh, me too.
If he ran right now, I'd vote for it. I would. But I just am shocked, and I've been around this state my entire life. I'm 55 years old, and I've been shocked by the kind of sentiment and support that they give to someone that is a New Yorker.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming either. And this is the state where Trump enjoys his highest approval rating.
I know. This is the, you know, if the rest of the country were like Trump, he wouldn't have a problem. I mean, we're like Trump, but was like it is in Alabama with regard to President Trump. He wouldn't have any problem getting anything through. He could come back to Alabama and run for governor. He'd win in a landslide.
You think he could beat Nick Saban?
You know what? That would be interesting.
That would be a fascinating election. Donald Trump versus Nick Saban.
I still think football wins out.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
But and neither one of them, why in the world would they want to pick up like that? Either one of them. Nick Saban makes more than 20 governors.
Yeah, I mean, do you know how much power he would have to give up to be the governor?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of the state?
Why would he want to step down like that? He makes $9 million a year.
Yeah, I wasn't even talking about monetarily, though. I mean,
oh, I know.
I was talking about influence.
Oh, influence and power, because he has more than anybody in this state. That's for certain.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call. You have a good one.
Take care.
All right. So I think that there's actually a lot of truth to that, that when we're talking about popularity contest, and that's essentially what this is, a lot of it just boils down to name recognition. And that's one of the things that we were talking about. And that's one thing that I think is going to be a real problem for the next candidate that we're going to talk about. You may recall that we were just reading a quote by Mo Brooks saying, hey, if he runs, I'm going with Arnold Mooney. Now, most of you are probably sitting at home thinking, who the heck is Arnold Mooney? And to be honest, I'd only heard his name a couple of times before Mo Brooks mentioned it himself. And Arnold Mooney is a representative from Shelby County. And he's actually one of the more conservative members of the House of Representatives. And if you look at his voting record, comparatively, he is more conservative than most of them. But he announced his candidacy also this morning on Talk 99.5. So very busy day. And he was on with Del Jackson at WVNN. So he's just making all the rounds for the Cumulus stations, apparently. I got in touch with him a little bit earlier today. Wasn't able to touch base with him. But hopefully we'll have him on in the next couple days, too. But if you're looking at exactly what's going on here, solid voting record. Really conservative voting record. Which honestly surprised me a lot. It really did. Not because I think that it's obviously a bad thing to have a conservative voting record. It's more that I'm surprised that I haven't heard more out of him, considering how conservative his voting record is. And I don't remember his name being on a whole bunch of bills, and I don't remember him doing a whole lot of impassioned speeches or debates. I mean, I've heard his name and I've seen him around a little bit. I think what's going on here, if I had to classify what I kind of see as this candidate's strengths and weaknesses, he seems to me, and I could be wrong, but he seems to me to be more of a slightly quieter Jeff Sessions. Because you'll remember when Jeff Sessions was in the Senate, you'll remember that, yeah, he would occasionally get a headline, but it was far more common to see people more like Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, when it came to conservative voting records. Even though Jeff Sessions had a very conservative record, he kind of got overlooked, not through anything that he was doing wrong per se, just that he wasn't somebody that was bombastic and all that stuff. And I think that's probably pretty similar to who Arnold Mooney is, just based on my initial impression of him. And I may adjust that as time goes on. He may get louder. He may be somebody that draws more attention. But as of right now, he seems more of the quiet conservative type. And if you're looking throughout history at who he would more reflect, and by the way, I take this as a huge compliment, but I'm not even talking about policy standpoint. I'm talking about sort of demeanor. He seems a little bit more like a Calvin Coolidge type. Somebody that is okay with speaking and doesn't mind speaking, but he's not a very showy person, based on what I'm seeing. Again, he could completely change my mind, I don't know, but it seems like that's not really who he is. And in a state where name recognition matters as much as Alabama does, I don't know that he's going to be able to overcome that. But if you're looking at his voting record just based on sheer, you know, meat and potatoes, what did the guy actually vote for? It's very solid. First of all, he supported the abortion ban that we've been talking about earlier this week. And he was also instrumental in the occupational licensing bill that helped reduce red tape, help more people get into the workforce, reduce the requirements for some of the occupational licenses, and sort of updating and reforming some of the practices that weren't working anymore or didn't make sense. So he's very good on that. He also sponsored the Right to Work bill and is a big proponent of term limits. So both of those things, really good for his conservative voting credentials. He actually sponsored the Right to Work bill. And when he talks about term limits, he is in favor of them at the federal level, at the state level. So I really do think, based on what I'm seeing here, he's pretty conservative, and he is one of only 18 Republicans that did not vote for the gas tax, which is impressive because that passed with huge Republican numbers, and he's one of the few people that voted against it, which pretty much automatically makes him one of the more conservative members of the House and Congress as a whole. Furthermore, when asked about the lottery here in the state of Alabama, and again, it's a little odd because I do want to hear his opinion on state matters, of course, but when you're running for the Senate, I really thought that he would be talking more about stuff going on at the federal level, but he talked mostly shop about some of what's going on here in Alabama, which again, fine. I like what he's saying. I think that he's got the right position on a lot of these issues. I was just really kind of expecting him to talk more of what's going on at the federal level, but I mean, I guess state issues are where he's really knowledgeable because that's where he is right now. And if he applies these same principles to the federal level, in large part, he'll be somebody that I would be able to get on board with. But he also is opposed to the lottery, and he said, and I quote, a no across the board. So not only no in its current form, I guess you would say, even if they were to amend it to be a clean lottery bill, nope, doesn't matter, still going to oppose it. Which, again, that makes him one of the most conservative members in the House of Representatives. Guy has a very good voting record. And he says in one of his interviews earlier this week that the people of Alabama want a conservative, but also want someone who's an outsider. I don't know that this is the smartest strategy if this is the way he's going to be moving forward. Now, granted, he's not really a swamp person. He's not like we were talking about last week, John Rogers, who has been in office for more than I've been alive, actually significantly more years than I've been alive. He just got into the House of Representatives in 2014. So to say that he is a political outsider isn't 100% true because he has been in office now for presumably about 5 years and will have been close to six when he's, you know, really in the heat of the primary. But, you know, he is kind of from the outside. He hasn't been a politician that long. And based on his voting record, he doesn't seem to be somebody that's more of a member of the establishment. He seems to buck the trend when he feels that the trend needs to be bucked, and that's a good thing. However, I don't know that I would rely too heavily on that if I were his campaign manager. Not because I don't think that it's something that is politically prudent. I just think based on who his competition is, that's not really a good line of attack. And the reason I say that is Bradley Byrne is not somebody that's been in office forever. I mean, he's been in office about as long as Representative Mooney has, so I don't think that he could make the case that, oh, I'm an outsider, but Bradley Byrne is an entrenched Washington bureaucrat. I don't think that you could make that case. You could definitely say he's a Washington bureaucrat as opposed to me, who is in Montgomery at the State House. You can make that case, even though it's a little harder to make that case just because it's a more complicated way to explain that to voters. But ultimately, because Tuberville is in the race especially, I think it's really hard to paint yourself as the political outsider. And the reason I say that is because Tuberville's never held political office. He's a football coach. And he is already hitting pretty hard that outsider mentality and talking about how similar he is to President Donald Trump in that respect. And so the people that being a political outsider is something that's very important to them, Tuberville probably has that locked more or less. He has that vote pretty much locked up, I would guess. maybe I'm wrong, but if you're somebody that the main problem that you have with politicians is the fact that they're politicians, you're probably not voting for Mooney. You're probably just not voting for Arnold Mooney. You're probably voting for Tommy Tuberville in this case. And so I would advise him not to hit that particular line of if I were doing a stump speech, I wouldn't make it one of the key points. That's the way that I'll say it. But nonetheless, he's only been a politician since 2014, so I guess that's kind of... He's still on the inside, though. He's still on the inside of Montgomery. And that's the main problem that I have with this. And another thing, too, he's just going to have a hard time casting Byrne or Ziegler, either one of them, as insiders, because they kind of have that rebel streak that goes against the establishment as well. And so he's just in a race where that's not a smart thing to make a core principle of your campaign. So really what it boils down to is, from a political perspective, regardless of whether you like his voting record, regardless of whether you like what he stands for, does the guy have a chance? Does he have a chance to actually get elected and then beat Doug Jones? Well, first of all, I'll say, just at my initial finding, I cannot think of a Republican candidate that will not beat Doug Jones in Alabama. In fact, I'm guessing there's going to be so much Republican turnout as backlash from Doug Jones being elected, I don't think you could run my right boot for office and he wouldn't beat Doug Jones at this point. So from an electability standpoint in the general, I think he's fine. If you're asking me about whether or not he can win the primary, I have my doubts. And the reason is because he has very, very low name recognition. And I think that's probably why he's announcing so earlier. Because when you announce your candidacy is huge in political circles. You're seeing right now in the latest polls, several polls have shown this, this poll is not an outlier, that Joe Biden is somewhere in the 40s in the Democrat primary, and in a head-to-head matchup, he's beating Donald Trump 45-51%. Now, do I think that's how it's actually going to play out in the 2020 election? Not right now. I don't think there's any strong indication of that. But if you're looking at those good poll numbers, the reason Joe Biden is having those good poll numbers is because there's an old saying in politics that the day you announce is your best day. Everything else is downhill from there. And they're usually right. There are some exceptions to that, but by and large, that's the rule and it's true. And so because of that, typically what people want to do is they want to wait for the field to get filled up and then jump in a little bit later so that they can enjoy that boost in the polls and get a little momentum going over their political opponents. I don't think that that's what Mooney is doing right now, because if you have name recognition that is as bad as his, even though it's a little bit more desperate, you want to jump in as early as possible. Because keep in mind, we're still a long ways away from November 2020. That is a long way into the future, and in political terms, it's basically an eternity. But nonetheless, he's throwing his name in very early. I think that's because he knows his name recognition is bad, and so because of that, any boost that he might see from announcing, he really would rather put that towards, he's willing to sacrifice that boost later on in order to get his name out there earlier. And politically, it's a smart move. That's what I would have done. In fact, if I were giving him advice, I probably would have had him announce even earlier, because he needs as long as humanly possible for people to have an opportunity to hear his name and generate some interest. So I think that he knows that name recognition being bad is his biggest problem, and he's doing the best that he can to try to overcome that really big obstacle in his path to victory. Now, he can run on his record, and that helps him. He has a very good voting record. Like I said, we just laid that out. But so do Byrne and so do Ziegler. They're pretty conservative. And so because of that, he's going to have a hard time differentiating himself from a conservative perspective as to why the Republicans should pick him in the primary. So, again, it helps to have a good record, but in this case, it doesn't help as much as it probably should. And another thing, too, that I think we do need to consider, Mo Brooks' endorsement is going to help him with Mo Brooks voters. In other words, people like me, who are big fans of Mo Brooks, are going to be encouraged to vote for him because he has Mo Brooks' endorsement. And so the people like me that were planning on voting for Mo Brooks, if he got into the election, are going to kind of transfer over to Mooney. But I don't know if that's going to be 100% transfer. And even if it were, Mo Brooks was not the one leading in the polls. Oddly enough, Roy Moore was. Now, Brooks was second, and Roy Moore hasn't declared yet, so that helps, I think, Mooney a lot. But I don't think that it's going to be 100% transfer rate, and even if it were, it's not something that's going to guarantee him victory, especially with the other factors that are holding him back, like I just brought out. And I don't know. I guess if I were to summarize it and give you sort of a quick view what I think about it, I think he's a long shot. I wouldn't say that he has no chance, but I would be very surprised if we're looking at a Republican Senate candidate, Arnold Mooney, when it's time for the 2020 general election to come up. Not impossible. And I like the guy. I think that he's got a great record. I wish for the best. But I kind of run into the same problem that I had with Rand Paul in the presidential primary. Love Rand Paul. Rand Paul, I mean, just about nobody has a better voting record than him when it comes to the Senate. And I really wanted Rand Paul to be the candidate on the Republican primary, but right now, it just doesn't look like Mooney is electable, and that was Rand Paul's big problem. Rand Paul, I think the highest he ever got was, I don't know, maybe 11%, and that was like right after he announced, if I'm not mistaken, and he kind of trailed off and was floating in the single digits for the rest of the election. There would be no hesitancy whatsoever for me to vote for President Rand Paul. But the reason I wound up supporting Ted Cruz is not because I like Ted Cruz necessarily better than Paul. It was because Ted Cruz had a legitimate shot at winning that primary. Rand Paul didn't. And so I had to consider electability as a part of it. And since they were pretty much dead even in every other category, I wound up going with the one that was slightly more electable. Actually, a lot more electable. No offense intended to Rand Paul. You know I love Rand Paul. But I think that's going to be the same thing here. Even though I like Mooney and I like the things that I'm seeing from him, I'm probably going to wind up backing someone else. And like I said, if I had to make the choice today, Jim Ziegler would be the one I'd want to back if he were in the race. If Jim Ziegler doesn't declare, and he may not, then maybe I consider Mooney. Bradley Byrne, I don't think, would be a bad option, but Mooney might not either. And so I think that that's going to play a pretty big role in it for me. Again, I don't tell you how to vote, but I do tell you how I'm going to vote. All right, looks like we're about to wind down on time here, so why don't we go to a quick break, and when we come back, we'll do one more segment and then wrap it up, because there is one other local story I want to bring up, and it actually has to do with the Senate race. Is Tommy Tuberville a carpetbagger? We answer that question in just a second.
And now for a reading from the Social Justice Warrior Bible. With Pastor Gregory Post.
Welcome in. I'm Gregory Post, head pastor at the Eternal Living Word Transdenominational Community Church and Coffee House in Novato, California. Now it's time for a reading from the SJW Bible. Today's reading will come from Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 through 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting the fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And the fire came out of the presence of the Lord, which created a wicked cool light show for them to see and totally got everyone feeling the Spirit's presence. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'Even though I didn't command you to use this strange fire, I totally understand your need to express yourselves in worship and keep yourselves entertained.' So Aaron therefore danced and yelled with joy, knowing that his sons were having a good time at worship. Moses called out to Mishael and Ezaphan, and the son of Aaron's uncle Uzziel, and said to them, 'Come forward, carry your relatives away in front of the sanctuary outside of the camp, for they have fainted from being overwhelmed by the power of God's coolness.' So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics outside the camp, as Moses had said. Then Moses said to Aaron and his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, 'Do not uncover your heads, nor tear your clothes, because God wants us to always be happy, and as long as we're happy, He's happy. Therefore, if worship doesn't give you an overwhelming sense of euphoria, you need to find another congregation, preferably one with a more dynamic pastor and band. So they did according to the word of Moses. And the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the sanctuary, so that you will be able to drink more once you arrive. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, between the unclean and the clean, because when worship stops being fun or feels judgy, then it becomes profane and unclean. Wow, so inspiring. This has been a reading from the SJW Bible, and remember, the only truth that matters is your truth.
And welcome back. Thanks so much for being with us through the break. Tommy Tuberville, he is, of course, running for Senate in the state of Alabama, hoping to be the opponent for Doug Jones on the Republican ticket. But is he a carpetbagger? This whole thing came about because we found out that Tuberville actually did move from the state of Florida back in the year 2018. So not that long ago, back in August, turns out Tommy Tuberville moved from the state of Florida to the state of Alabama, and he announced his Senate run, about, 2 weeks ago? So because of that, there are people speculating that he made that move intentionally so that he would be able to run for the Senate in Alabama. And Bradley Byrne, who is currently running for the same spot and the primary opponent of Tommy Tuberville, was asked about this the other day. And he said, and I quote, "We don't like carpetbaggers in Alabama. I mean, the idea that you have to be near an airport. There's an airport in Mobile, an airport in Montgomery, an airport in Birmingham and Huntsville. I mean, if you want to live in Auburn, you're an hour and a half away from one of the largest airports in the world. That just doesn't cut it." Now, I like Bradley Byrne, and if given the option right now, I would pick Byrne over Tuberville. But this is a really dumb attack. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, why is living near an international airport something that's going to be a big deal? Also, why are we surprised that Tommy Tuberville chose to live in Auburn? That's the city he lived in when he was head football coach. So, I don't understand this thing. It was like, he has to be near an airport so that he can leave the state whenever he wants to. He's got to be near, and you can't live near Montgomery or live Birmingham. That's stupid. Of course the guy lives in Auburn. It's the only place in Alabama he's ever lived. And Auburn is one of the fastest growing areas in the state and the country. I think it was maybe 3-4 years ago that it was the 11th fastest growing city in America. I mean, you talk about a place that's really on the upswing and dynamic. Auburn, Alabama is it. And so I really don't understand why Bradley Byrne is trying to attack the guy for living in Auburn. That should surprise literally no one. He used to be the head coach at Auburn and lived there for over a decade. Of course he chose Auburn to move to. That makes sense. And another thing, too, this idea that, he's a carpetbagger. This is a textbook example of an ad hominem logical fallacy. That you're attacking the person, not the issue at hand. I've been very critical of Tuberville. You can go look on my YouTube channel and look at just a segment that I did where I talk for, I don't know, about 15 minutes about all of Tuberville's weaknesses, how I don't think that he's adequately prepared to run for the Senate. I went by his interviews and talked about some of the different things that he's brought up that they just don't seem to me to be the policies and the words of somebody that has really carefully considered this and fully understands what being in the Senate means. As of right now, Tuberville is my least favorite out of the Republican candidates. And again, not to say that I dislike Tuberville. I think he's a great guy. and somebody that I would love to meet, somebody I'm trying to get on my show right now. It's not that I hate Tuberville. But Bradley Byrne, this is a really stupid way to go after your opponent. If you want to go after him on substance. Go after him on his lack of experience. Any of those things. That's fair game. Saying that the guy's a carpetbagger just because he moved here, what, more than 6 months ago? And saying that he only did that because of so he could run for the Senate? It's a stupid line of attack and it's beneath you. And another thing, too. The whole idea that Tuberville is a carpetbagger, the guy lived in Alabama for a while. He lived here for over a decade. Why should we be surprised that he moved back? Now, maybe he did move back just so he could run for the Senate. I don't know. I can't read the man's mind. But there's certainly no evidence to suggest that. And I don't think that him having just recently moved back to Alabama, let's not pretend that he's somebody like the guy we talked about a couple weeks ago that lived in Florida and contemplated moving to Alabama specifically to run. This is a guy who lived in Alabama for a very long time beforehand. I just don't understand this line of attack. Tuberville is not somebody that just has never lived in Alabama before, decided he wanted to be a U.S. Senator, or saw that as the easiest way to do it and moved to Alabama. This is a guy that does have roots here. He's not originally from the state, but you also have to remember that he's got family that lives here. His son went to school here. I mean, this is not somebody that has no ties to Alabama whatsoever and is only here because he wants to be a senator. It's a dumb line of attack, and Bradley Byrne's better than this. There's just better ways to score political points than this, and that's really my bottom line here. There's plenty of legitimate ways to attack Tommy Tuberville politically if you want to say something against your political opponent. This is not a good way to do it. All right, so that being said, it's time for us to go now to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
You messed it up. You're stupid.
Today's Daily Dose of Stupid goes to the House Democrats. All of them. Because what they're trying to do now is they are trying to hold Barr in contempt of Congress. And the reason they are trying to hold the Attorney General in contempt of Congress is because, according to them, and I mean this is accurate, he refused to release the full Mueller report. There's a number of reasons this is really, really stupid. Which, first of all, I don't think that being in contempt of Congress should even be something that you could bring up against someone, because I personally have contempt for Congress. And based on their approval ratings, most Americans on both sides of the aisle also have contempt for Congress. So I find it a little weird that you can even bring that up as a charge. I understand that it's different in the legal definition, but you get what I'm saying. But you have to remember that it would be illegal and should be illegal for you to release information on somebody that was not convicted of a crime. You can't just release evidence on somebody when that evidence didn't lead to something that would have been reasonable to bring a case forward on. You could use a grand jury, for example. That's not something that you're supposed to do with somebody that they couldn't bring up enough charges to even declare that we should have a case about it, much less that the guy was actually guilty. And that's the reason those records are going to be sealed by law. Which means that the Democrats are asking William Barr, who is the chief law enforcement person in the United States of America, they are asking him to break the law and threatening, because the vote will be held on Wednesday, and are threatening to hold him in contempt of Congress if he doesn't break the law. Well, if that's the case, then the Democrats are the ones suggesting that he break the law. They're the ones that are trying to get him to do something that would be illegal. And if the option is be held in contempt of Congress or break the law, I'm going to choose to be in contempt of Congress. And it's hilarious to me that Congress is the one that is suggesting that he, the person that is in charge of enforcing laws in the United States of America, should be breaking the laws to fit their political whims. What they're doing, what they're asking him for, is illegal, and they know it. They know they are specifically trying to put him in a no-win situation, that regardless of what action he chooses to take, he's going to be in legal trouble. That was the plan from the beginning. That's what they've been trying to do this whole time. Because they know there's nothing in the Mueller report. Because here's another thing, too, the way that you know that. Bob Mueller has said that everything that is being presented is accurate. Said it on three different occasions. If Bob Mueller was hiding the ball or keeping important details of this 400-page report, over 90% of it, which is not redacted, if Bob Mueller, who is the one who wrote the report, is saying that there were important details that got left out, all he would have to do is tell Congress. But he hasn't done it. In fact, he said the exact opposite. He said that Barr's summary of the report was accurate. Three different occasions. The Democrats are just mad that the report didn't turn out the way that they wanted it to. And that's where they're trying to get rid of Mueller. That's why they're trying to get him into some kind of political hot water, because they don't like the results. And so they don't know how to handle that, because the Democrats are essentially a bunch of children that never learned how to control their emotions. And so when something doesn't go their way, they throw a temper tantrum. That's the best way to describe this whole thing. And to put this into perspective, because sometimes when you're looking at things on the national level, it's helpful to scale it down to something very small so you can understand why something is wrong. This would be like if you had the sheriff of a town. Actually, scratch that. It would be like the mayor of a town telling the sheriff that he needs to go out and he needs to find something on this citizen that the mayor happens to not like. And he says, look, there's reasonable suspicion here. Here's a list of things that we think there might be something to it. And the sheriff goes out, does an investigation, comes back and says, I'm sorry, couldn't find anything on him. And then they take it to a grand jury and they say, nope, there's no reason to pursue this guy. We don't think that he's done anything wrong. I mean, there may have been suspicion there, but when we examined the evidence, it turned up empty. And then the mayor said, well, I want to see everything in that grand jury verdict. I want to see everything that they had to consider, everything that you dug up on this person. And the sheriff says, no, that's against the law. I can't do that. At that point, it's very clear that what the mayor of that town is doing, he's not interested in pursuing justice or nailing somebody that is actually guilty of a crime. He's trying to dig up dirt on somebody. He's trying to find anything, basically going on a fishing expedition to try to pull up anything he can to ruin this guy. And the sheriff is saying, well, you're going to get fired unless you give me this information. Okay, in that case, the sheriff has two options. Get fired for doing his job or break the law. Now, Congress obviously doesn't have the power to fire Mueller. But what I'm saying here is, it's the same kind of scenario that it's very clear that what Congress is doing, they set out on this whole thing specifically so they could find some kind of dirt that they could use on Donald Trump. The thing turned up empty, which is nothing short of miraculous, in my opinion. I mean, there are very few people that if you had a 2-year-long investigation, you couldn't find something on them. I was shocked that Trump was as clean as he was. But nonetheless, that's what happened. And the Democrats don't like the results of the investigation. And so now they're saying that William Barr is going to be held in contempt of court if he doesn't break the law in order to fulfill whatever it is, whatever their political agenda is, essentially. They're asking him to do something that is illegal, and that's why this is so incredibly, incredibly stupid. But here's the thing, and this is something that has been suggested about William Barr. I remember that Doug Jones, you may recall the other day, we were talking about this comment, that he said that William Barr was just acting as the president's personal attorney. He wasn't really acting like an attorney general, and he's just doing this big cover-up for the Trump administration to try to keep the details of the Mueller report out of the public eye. I gotta say, Mueller is woefully incompetent. The guy just sucks at his job, because if he's supposed to be the personal attorney for the Trump administration, and he's supposed to hide everything that he can to keep Trump out of trouble. Gosh, he sucks at that. Because he released the report, even though he wasn't required to by law, he released a report that was 90% not redacted and included a lot of details that make Trump look bad. Obviously nothing illegal, but things that make Trump look like somebody that's not a very good boss and has a temper and that kind of thing. And here's the thing. If this were somebody's personal lawyer, and Doug Jones knows this, you would never intentionally release information about your client, even if it wasn't illegal. You don't release information that you don't have to. You just don't do that as an attorney. And so if William Barr is acting as the president's personal attorney, and he's trying to hide the body by releasing a 400-page report on the man, man, he sucks at his job if that's the case. He is the worst attorney that there has ever been, if that is what's going on here. But the truth is, that's not what's going on here at all. The Democrats, including Doug Jones, are just mad that the report didn't turn out the way that they wanted it to. And because Trump is bad, then they're going to do absolutely anything in their mind. Anything is justified to do anything that hurts or gets rid of President Trump. Doesn't matter if it's immoral. Doesn't matter if it's illegal. As long as they get rid of Trump because Orange Man bad, then they're satisfied no matter what the means are. The end justifies the means in their mind. And that is a dangerous way of thinking in politics or in anything else. Let's go on to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's Report is going to continue on in the Book of Daniel. And we do want to take a quick look at that. So in the Book of Daniel, you may recall, if you have been paying attention to us, in the previous installment that we looked at the very end of chapter 5, King Belshazzar was killed the very night that Daniel predicted that he would be. And what happened is the Medes and the Persians took over the Empire of Babylon, and now King Darius is in charge instead of King Belshazzar. And now the Medes and the Persians are running things. So because of this, as you can imagine, there was quite a bit of political upheaval and rearranging of everything. And King Darius is starting to restructure how the government works and how it's supposed to function and the jurisdictions and everything. It's kind of like, imagine when a new president or a new governor comes in and he starts rearranging the staff and rearranging how things are done, but on steroids, because he's not just a governor, he's the king. And so basically anything he says goes. And so there's a massive upheaval in the castle, in the palace there. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it was not uncommon back then for when a king took over, he took over the subjects of the previous king. And so those people that used to work for King Belshazzar are now working for Darius, and he's trying to figure out the pecking order here. And that's what we're going to see in Daniel chapter 6, verses 3 through 5, which reads, "Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and the satraps began finding a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they couldn't find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, insomuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, 'We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of God.'" This is a theme that Daniel was not unfamiliar with. You may recall very early on in the book of Daniel that right after his first big win, I guess, as it were, with King Nebuchadnezzar, he immediately had other people vying for his position and trying to undermine him. And one thing that it shows to me as a political commentator is that things don't change very much. Politics was a blood sport then, and it's a blood sport now. Now we're a little bit kinder about it, and there's less violent overthrows, but at the end of the day, it's still a bunch of people trying to get to the top and everybody trying to undermine everybody else. And this is what's going on right here, is that when King Darius is trying to restructure and figure out, okay, who's best for this position, who's best for this position, there are all these people that are saying, wow, this Daniel guy's rising to the top pretty quickly. We should probably do something to keep that from happening because we'd really like to be in that position. And so it's a very almost high school-esque environment here where there's constant backbiting and betrayal and trying to one-up each other. That seems to be the environment that is being discussed here in the scripture. And I think that it says something, and there's a couple big takeaways that we can have about the people that are doing this. First of all, it says a lot about you that you can't win unless you cheat. This is sort of a lesson in fair play, because the bad guys, the ones that are the enemies of Daniel, rather than being better at their job or trying to get the position that they want through honorable means, they'd rather sabotage other people. They would rather cheat their way to the top than earn it. And I think that really does say a lot about their character and their worldview, that they're perfectly okay and perfectly willing to do whatever it takes to be able to one-up this person. And we'll see later, that includes the other person dying. They're perfectly comfortable with either directly or indirectly killing other people if it means they get to advance. And that really is a sad state, to where you don't even value a person's life over your own position and prestige. It also says something about Daniel. I think it says something about Daniel, and it's something that we ought to emulate. That Daniel, being a man of God, his character is so above reproach that the only thing these guys can come up with to smear him, the only thing these guys can come up with to try to undermine Daniel and stop his rise to the top, is use his loyalty to God, his devotion, and his religion against him. That's the only thing they can come up with. They can't figure out any kind of way to attack his loyalty to the king or the kingdom. They can't attack the quality of his work. They can't attack his leadership ability. They can't come up with anything other than, let's figure out a way to use his loyalty to God as a weakness. And I think that that says a lot about the kind of person Daniel is, that he is somebody that does his best at work, that does his best as a citizen of the, well, technically he's not a citizen of the kingdom, he's still a Jew, but in his position and the place that he finds himself in, he does the very best he can to serve others, even though he's not in the ideal position. I'm sure that Daniel would have much rather been in Jerusalem, a free Jew worshiping God the way that God always intended. But even in this less than ideal situation, Daniel does the best that he can. And he seeks to serve God and to serve the people around him, to become a resource to them and help teach them about God. And we've seen in this story so far, he's had some limited success in that area. In some places, even though he's been able to teach, they haven't been very receptive to it, which isn't anything against Daniel. It's just that the people didn't receive God's truth as he presented it to them through Daniel. So I think it says a lot about Daniel's character that even though we're talking about secular work and secular positions here, that he's able to rise to the top because people realize that his conviction to God and his, which crafts his character, makes his character so above reproach that nobody can find anything to say ill about him. And I think it speaks to what we're supposed to do, that we, in our modern society, are supposed to do the best that we can to adhere to the law, to be model citizens, and to be the kind of person that you would want as a neighbor, or as an employee, or as a friend. Christians should be the best of all those things. I think that it was Voltaire, who was not somebody that was a believer in God, who said that he wished that every single person around him would be a Christian, just because it meant that he was less likely to be cheated and that he would be surrounded with virtuous people. See, even somebody that didn't believe that God was real understood that a belief in God drives people to be better than they would be otherwise. And that's what's going on here, that Daniel is so driven by his devotion to his Lord that it affects the rest of his life, that other people can see how strong he is and how really unblemished his character is because of that devotion. And that's really something that we should try to do the best that we can as well. See, if we break the law, it's only because there was absolutely no way to do so other than breaking God's law. That's the only thing that we should do when it comes to the law. We should be doing the best that we can to adhere to every law, unless it conflicts with God's law, which we're going to see as a theme of this chapter here in a moment. And it should also mean that whenever we offend someone or we say something that may seem unkind, we only do that if we have to do so to be in accordance with God's law. We make no meaningless or empty offenses unless we're doing so because we're teaching the truth about who God is. That in every respect, and that obviously isn't a license to be unkind when you're teaching them about the truth of God, I'm just saying that it means that if we ever have to lovingly correct somebody, we should never do so for our own motivations, or we should never do so overly harshly, but we should only do it because we know that they're in violation of God's law and there would be a problem. They would be in spiritual danger if we did it. That's the kind of man Daniel was, and it's the kind of person that we should strive to be every single day. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.